to be honest. You know, like looking back, there was a massive amount of emotional abuse from the very start before I was ever sexually assaulted.
And what form did that come in?
Like insulting me, but picking me up. So I was a 15, 16 year old teenager. Like most teenagers, I grappled with insecurities. I would have been a bit quieter, like a bit more reserved, where I wouldn't have been totally comfortable going to teenage discos, and I would have been really self-conscious about my weight. And he'd say things like, you know, you'd be so pretty if you just lost a bit of weight, or you'd be so, you know, those really horrific things for a grown man to be telling you.
When you're there to mind.
Yeah, when you're there to mind.
His children. Yeah. So that began to chip away at confidence.
Yeah, confidence. And because I already, I suppose, believed that about myself, it was kind of, it was so cunning the way it was done. You know, it wasn't so obvious, but I had believed that. So because there was a grown man telling me that, it reinforced it more into my thinking, you know.
And when did things begin to change further?
Things began to change just one night. I was never given a bed in the house for a long period of time. And my house is only 2 kilometres down the road. So they would come home from their night out and the taxi would go and I'd sleep on the couch. And the first night of the first assault, I went to the sitting room and there were glass doors in the house and I said goodnight to him and all the lights went off in the house. They were flicking one off by the other, you know, and I was expecting to hear him go upstairs, and he came into the sitting room and forced himself onto me on a couch like I was like an animal.
And did you tell anyone about that?
No.
You continued to babysit for them because you were so, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but confused by what happened?
Totally confused. But like from that very first assault, all my feelings of any value or worth totally, any feelings that I had as a 16-year-old girl, totally vanished. So, like, I'm from a very normal rural community and he would have been friendly with extended family and other neighbours, and it just wasn't an option for me to tell someone because I thought I was wrong.
And I only ask you, and I know it's so difficult to sound like I'm questioning why you didn't tell anybody or... Because I think it's important that people know what that does to a person.
I think it is, because a lot of times people would say, well, why didn't you tell, you know, or why did you wait so long to report it to me or about other victims or survivors? And it's so hard to put into words what that very first assault did. And it only multiplied after that. Like each and every assault was accompanied by the most degrading, demeaning comments about my body. So it's horrific.
And when I said the word confused, I perhaps could have even picked a better word, but it just means it's thrown you into a whole different realm. Something has been taken from
you. Yeah, totally.
And you're not thinking sensibly anymore because of what has happened. When did you get to a point where you needed this to stop?
So with regards to the babysitting, I had tried to make multiple attempts to stop, but he started contacting my mother to see would I come and babysit. And like my parents, like as far as they were concerned, they knew him. Like I was in a safe place. Go and get your €20 for the night, you know, your bit of pocket money. And I eventually just really put the foot down. But then when I stopped, he followed me to public spaces.
And there were a couple of occasions where you were assaulted outside of his home.
which was just totally like, I'll never be free of this.
And at this stage, you're 17, heading into 18, you're leaving CERT. Yeah. These were huge, huge developmental parts of your life.
Yeah.
Were you able to be present for any of those?
No, no. I just totally, like, you know, as you kind of said earlier, it's like that whole different realm. Like, it's like total disorientation. Like, it's so hard to put words on what it does and where I was then. But, like, I know the judge said, and it was reported, that I couldn't go to my debs. Like, I couldn't go to my graduation. I couldn't get out of bed, you know. And when I did get out of bed, I lived a pretty crazy life, you know. It was horrific.
And were you going through many of the motions of getting up, going to school, carrying on until you couldn't?
Yeah. Like, I wasn't able to go to school. I wasn't able to commit to doing my leave insert. Like, I didn't look forward to it. I didn't, you know, I look now at my little cousins or friends' children that I know who are doing their exams, and it's like an exciting, like, it's an exciting time. You're looking forward to your future. You're thinking about the CAO. It just, like, I put more effort into thinking, how am I going to end my life?
You said things were wild as well, because there were coping mechanisms that
totally,
you were leaning on.
Yeah, totally.
Tell us a bit about that.
Well, I am a recovering alcoholic today, and I would have relied an awful lot on alcohol to get myself through the day and to numb that deep-rooted shame and hurt and confusion that I had. And didn't care about myself, didn't care for myself. I suppose just trying to escape everything that I had to endure.
And I think you're explaining it so brutally, but so honestly.
Yeah.
And I think it'll really resonate with people, because anyone who says, well, why didn't you just X, Y and Z? Because you're not in your right mind anymore.
No.
You've gone to another place because of how hurt you are, and you're trying to
totally.
Process what's not
totally.
Processable.
And, like, not only was I not able to do that, like, not only was I living like that, but it had a ripple effect on my family. And people were probably looking in at our house and saying, like, what's going on with that girl? You know, could she not just settle, and her poor mother and her poor father? And the only person who knew the cause of all my problems was Martin O'Brien. And while he was out in our local community, building relationships and forming friendships and being a great community man, my home, myself, my body, my mind and my family, we were totally disrupted, disorientated.
What was the turning point? When did you decide to speak out about what was going on?
The turning point was, I suppose, COVID. I had gotten sober in 2018, and I kind of made a conscious decision that I would just put it aside. And I suppose that comes from the fear of not being believed and disrupting things within my extended family and the community. And then when COVID came, I moved home for the first time in years, and I couldn't stay at home. I had to move back to the city. And, you know, I had a conversation with my parents, and they both said, it's time now if you want to do something. I was also in counselling and seeking a lot of support, and I had been since 2018. So I had gotten to myself to the point where I felt ready to.
And you'd started to believe in yourself and back yourself a little bit. That can't have been easy to do, to stop drinking, to say this destructive behaviour isn't going to help me. I need to help myself. That's not an easy thing to do on you.
Well, like, I wanted to, you know, I wanted to live, and I knew I was going to die if I continued on the way I lived. And I knew that maybe some people hoped I would, that I would never be able to report what had happened to me. But it's a gift also as well. It's a total gift.
And you deserve to live. You did nothing wrong.
Yeah.
How did you find the reporting process?
The reporting process, it was daunting. Like, it was it was daunting. I suppose my biggest fear, the actual process with the detectives in the Protective Services Unit, they were brilliant. You know, gone are the days now where you have to go into your local guard station and report something as major as that, you know. And that was very comfortable. And I suppose I wasn't really fully aware of the whole legal process. I just gave my statement and told them what he had done to me and what had happened to me. Looking back now, I was totally consumed with fear about disrupting. That was a major fear of mine, was disrupting my extended family, maybe, or blood relatives or neighbours. And fear of not being believed totally was huge. And it's funny, like, because the last nearly 5 years now since I reported it, I realise now, being at the other side of this, that there are people who are going to support you and there are people who won't. And there will be people who will not believe you and they will look and turn the blind eye. And they at times can reinforce that self-doubt and that lack of self-worth. But for me today now, being at the other side of it, they really don't matter. They really don't matter. And I never thought that myself back in 2020, when I was at the start of this reporting process, and even times during it, would be able to feel that in my heart, in my gut, that, you know, they don't matter. I have a really full life today. I live a full life and my life isn't reduced or minimised in any way because those people aren't in it.
And you've done a huge amount of work on yourself, and you'd gotten all that support and got strong in yourself. Yeah. That didn't mean it didn't impact on you, but that's where you've ended up after all of that.
Yeah, that's where I've ended up. And it's because of the support that I got and because of the services like the Galway Rape Crisis Centre, the Dublin Rape Crisis Centre, all the rape crisis centres and all the amazing counselling and therapy I have gotten, you know, the last 10 years. And I sought it, and it's not easy. Like I did say in my victim impact statement, like while friends of mine were emigrating to Australia and, you know, planning their lives, I was in a room in counselling. You know, it takes a lot of effort. And it takes an awful lot out of you, but it does work, you know.
What about from reporting to sentencing? Because Martin O'Brien pled guilty, there was still a long wait time.
There was a long wait time.
What was that like for you and your family?
Oh, it was terrible. He pled guilty in April last year, 2024, and he was not sentenced until December. So we had a lot of days. We just couldn't plan. We couldn't do anything, you know, normal things. Just couldn't plan anything because we didn't know what day we'd have to be in court. And also it felt just so strange to me that he had pled guilty and that he was still out for that length of time, living his life, as I said, totally unimpeded. Even after I gave my victim impact statement in July, which I was apprehensive about doing for the fear, and I said it for the fear that he may relish in it, the same way I believe he totally relished in disrupting my life until I had reported the abuse.
And you read that in front of him.
Yeah.
How did that feel on the day?
It was powerful. It was empowering. It was nerve-wracking. I didn't expect it to happen, that I feel, and someone close to me said this, it was like, Anya, it was like you were walking over the bridge, but once you read that, you had just walked a bit more, you know, and we all kind of followed you. It really was, even though it was disappointing that he got to be released again and go home again, however he did have amended bail conditions, I still felt like I'm giving this back to him now. This is his and it belongs to him and only belongs to him. None of these feelings or none of the shame ever belonged to me. You know, there was a lot of healing in it and I'm glad I did it.
And obviously I would wish that you had never been on that journey, but I couldn't help but think of the Áine in that sitting room on that first night, to the Áine that stood up in that court. Yeah. That's an incredible point to be able to reach. There were also lots of stumbling blocks along the way, of course. You had to listen to character references read out about him, in particular from his wife. Can you tell us what that was like to experience?
It was just a total shock. We were in the court room. I was in the courtroom. I had my amazing family with me and my friends. And I had the brilliant support worker from the Dublin Rape Crisis Centre along with me. And his barrister called his wife to take the stand to read a character reference. And I was in shock, and I think everyone was in a bit of shock. And I felt like I was going to vomit. I felt like I was going to throw up. I could see her and she was reaching for the water, and I was just like, is this real life? You know, I had given my victim impact statement. I had handed over everything, and she was up in the stand, being able to give her reference about him. And she started off and it sounded like what I can only describe as a wedding speech that you'd hear someone, a bride or a groom, given. And I had my partner one side and the lovely, amazing support worker from the Dublin Rape Crisis Centre. And I think they both said, you don't have to listen to this. And I just got up and took my body and walked out, and my whole family followed me. And yeah, it was crazy.
And do you think we should look at character references in cases like this? I mean, we have to bear in mind that he pled guilty.
Totally, totally. It's just, it's so unnecessary. It's so damaging. I feel like it was a total show. Why didn't she just quietly hand in her reference? Why did she have to, why was she allowed to stand in front of me and sit and speak into a little microphone and declare her love for her husband and say what a great man he was? Because I didn't listen to it, I only read about it in the reports. And one of the things that she said was, and I'm going to paraphrase, was along the lines of that as a mother, she's concerned for me too. And I found that very insulting, and I still do.
Before we started to record, you were saying that through this process and journey, there would be times where people would cross to the other side of the street.
Mm, yeah.
Not knowing what to say.
Yeah.
Can you make peace with the idea that perhaps anyone close to him was also trying to manage their thoughts and feelings in this, and it can lead to all manner of things that we can't even comprehend?
I can't really. No, I can't.
And that, and absolutely, that is your right, and I completely feel that for you. And I don't think you should ever have been put in that position to sit and hear that in court. And I think that's something that should be changed.
I think if she was really concerned about me, as she said she was, she would have just handed it in, like the other character references that were given, you know.
There were ripples felt out among the community.
Mm.
What was that like to feel? You said there were people who didn't support you, and you've had to make peace with that.
Yeah, totally.
But you did feel support too.
Oh, a huge amount after he was sentenced. And I suppose I've heard an awful lot the last 4 months from people, you know, saying I did not know what to say and I did not know what to do. And I knew the last, particularly since he was charged in 2022, that people knew, you know, it's a small area, people knew. And I knew I was being talked about, and my family knew that we were being talked about, but no one was saying anything, and nearly avoiding us. And that's because I've heard now that people didn't know what to say or didn't know what to do. And had I only known the amount of support that was actually out there for me in my local community and beyond, I know this whole thing would have felt a little bit lighter. And it's a legal investigation. It's a whole process. Like, I am not allowed to speak about it. Witnesses are not allowed to speak about it. But there are ways of doing things without speaking about it. And I suppose it's not having the language. But all that, you know, someone has to say is, I'm thinking of you, you know. I remember there was one day I was in Galway City and I met someone and they would have been the least, you know, I would have least expected them to say something. And it was an older person. And they just put their hand on my shoulder and said, you're a great girl. And that meant so much because I knew where that was coming from. But they were few and far between up until he was sentenced. So even after he had pled guilty, it wasn't until the December, just 4 months ago, that I've kind of come to a stage, honestly, where it is lovely to get those words. You know, it is lovely to get them and to hear them and to know that you're supported and know that you're believed, like, is, of course it is. It's fantastic, like. But I've come to the stage where I kind of really don't care. You know, I really don't. But I hope that if there's someone listening to this that knows and believes someone who is in the middle of this process, just to let them know that you're thinking of them. And like, one great thing that worked for people who mightn't have the vocabulary and who would have great faith was sending mass cards, because you actually don't have to write anything, but equally you can get a thinking of you card. Or, you know, just the silence is deafening around all of this, and it's very similar to the actual abuse itself. And I think that certain things can be done to show support without having to say too much or ask any question.
Yeah, shame lives in silence, doesn't it?
Totally.
And the more we feel uncomfortable,
because
this is tough stuff, 100%. Yeah. But the more we take it out of silence, the less power it has over everybody, you and everybody who was feeling that.
Yeah.
What about now? Do you feel since the sentencing you have been able to move on?
Yeah, I do, totally. And I have been moving on forever, really, you know. I live a really good life. I live a life that I never thought I'd have, never thought I was deserving of. I'm studying a master's. I'm in the middle now of finishing up my final assignments. I'm creating, you know, I do feel sometimes, and obviously my life and my progression was delayed and there were a lot of barriers in my way. But because I seeked those services and because of places like the Galway Rape Crisis Centre and the Dublin Rape Crisis Centre, I'm able to live a life to the best of my ability. And I really want to, if there's, like, I can only describe those years of hell where I wasn't seeking any support and I was living in that, you know, that just total disorientation and shame and really just wanted it all to be over. And if there is anyone listening to this, just seek the support, you know. It's so much more accessible, I feel, or known about, or maybe it's just because I'm in these circles now, but from 2014 up until now. And I live a full life. I'm very grateful.
And you were able to return to your music, something you loved, something that you couldn't for a while.
Yeah, I returned to music and it has been great. And I've fabulous people in my life because of it, you know, through music. And it has given me great comfort. And as cheesy and all as that sounds, even the morning that we were in court last April, that we thought, you know, I thought I was going face into a trial, I had like my music, you know, a certain I was in therapy, obviously, and we were doing EMDR therapy. And I had these two pulses and my therapist gave them to me and they like pulse in your hand. And this was maybe about 2 months before what I thought was going to be a trial. And all I could think of was this march. It's called, it's a piece of music and it's called The Battle of Ockram. And I could hear it. And it was like, it just gave me great strength. And I've gotten that an awful lot through music.
So that support, I think that's just a really important message for people, that you do deserve it.
Yeah.
In reading some of your notes, you said it was like swallowing a stone and just having that sitting in the base of your stomach all of the time. Yeah. But when you reach for help, that load begins to lighten.
Lighten, totally, totally. Like I was able to come to a place to be able to report it after having sought the support and in continuing the support for myself and for no one else. And it is not easy. And it's not fun. Like counselling is heavy, you know, and going back there and dealing with life when you're carrying that amount is really heavy. But it is worth it.
Because the alternative is to stay as you were.
Yeah.
If you hadn't reached out for that support, that would have been a very dark place to stay as to where you found yourself now.
Yeah, totally. 100%.
Well, that person who put their hand on your shoulder and said you're a great girl, they were right. You should be so proud of your strength.
Yeah, thank you.
And that you did it for you. I think that first day when you said, no, I'm telling somebody, no, I'm not drinking anymore, it's not serving me, that spark of yourself that you brought back, that is really tougher than any court case, I think, or trial or sentencing or.
And that's another thing, like if there's someone who's listening to this who's going through this process, who was chosen to report and to go through this process, and this whole legal process, it's totally out of our control as well, which I think is important to mention. A lot of people say, would have said to me, fair play to you, brought it the whole way. I didn't bring it anywhere. He saw everything. I got to see, he saw the book of evidence, you know, I didn't get to see anything. It was the state. I was only viewed as a witness. But you've already had to endure the hardest part, which is the abuse and the violence itself. So anyone who is struggling right now going through this process of maybe having reported it and are awaiting a decision from the DPP or are awaiting a trial, or even outside of the legalities, if you're seeking the support now, you already have done the hard, have had to endure the hardest part of all of this and suffered it, which is the abuse itself. So you're actually well able for everything else. You know, you're able to heal and there, you know, there is life and light after this.
That has hit me hard. And I think that's why the language is important, that we say survivor now. We don't say victim. Yes, there was a perpetrator and there was a victim, but there's a survivor. Yeah.
There's a survivor. And it's funny as well, because I hear this language and I know it's not meant with any ill will. And I hear it probably from the older generation who are as good as they can be to even be able to talk about it. When they say like, move on, you know, move on now, you know, like a good girl nearly. And I want to say, and I say, yeah, I will. Yeah, thanks so much, you know. And inside I'm thinking like, what do you think I've been doing the last 10 years? Like 11 years. More, you know, 13 years. What do you think I have been doing? Like I've survived. And it's funny, I was uncomfortable with that word survivor for a long time. It just didn't sit well with me. But I'm comfortable with it because I'll continue to survive. And I have survived. And anyone who has had to endure sexual violence or abuse, emotional and everything that's embedded in it, and if they're still here today and if they're still living, they're surviving.